Hello and welcome to Science World. Since the need is so urgent, several experimental Ebola treatments are being put through the U.S. regulatory process at an incredibly fast pace. Jessica Berman will tell us how and why these promising treatments are being approved so quickly. Rebecca Ward tells us that officials with the European Space Agency's Rosetta mission this week have confirmed where, what day, and time its Philae lander will be touching down on Comet 67P. And a group of researchers in Denmark has conducted a review of a number of studies related to possible public health risks due to the increased consumption of those popular energy drinks. We'll find out what they learned when we talk with the review's lead author in today's one-on-one segment. We'll have these stories and more on today's edition of VOA's Science, Health, and Technology magazine, Science World. Experimental Ebola treatments are moving with lightning speed through a regulatory process that, for most drugs, can take years. The urgency of the lethal epidemic in West Africa means a number of promising treatments are bypassing the usual hurdles toward approval. Jessica Berman reports.
Before a new drug gets the green light from U.S. regulators, researchers are required to conduct in-depth clinical trials in people to demonstrate the experimental compound as both safe and effective. Drug trials typically involve thousands of people and can take many years to complete. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration's so-called animal rule, however, allows researchers to gain expedited approval when faced with a deadly pathogen like Ebola. According to Thomas Geisbert, a microbiologist at the University of Texas Medical Branch in Galveston, Geisbert helped develop what's known as the VSV Ebola vaccine, which this week moved to human clinical trials in 20 healthy volunteers at Walter Reed Army Institute of Research in Maryland. The animal rule, according to Geisbert, requires only that scientists demonstrate that a compound is effective in an animal model of human disease, in this case, monkeys.
And then in conjunction with that, you do a conventional phase one trial. So that's just a study where you put a vaccine or a treatment into a healthy human volunteer just to make sure that in normal healthy people that your vaccine or your drug does not cause any disease or serious adverse event.
An experimental drug, ZMapp, went straight from the laboratory to the bedside, even bypassing human safety trials to treat a handful of Ebola patients in the United States. Besides the VSV trial being carried out by Canadian researchers, another promising vaccine candidate, manufactured by British drug manufacturer GlaxoSmithKline, is undergoing safety trials in Mali. That country borders Guinea, the epicenter of the Ebola epidemic that has now claimed 4,000 lives in West Africa. So far, no cases of Ebola have been reported in Mali. Both vaccines proved to be 100% effective in protecting monkeys against infection with the Ebola virus without side effects. Expedited clinical trials also mean researchers may dispense with the usual protocol of giving a group of participants a placebo or an active substance so researchers can study a drug's effectiveness. The Ebola virus carries a 90% mortality rate. Bioethicists say it would be unethical to give a fake drug to people infected with the lethal pathogen. Double-blind placebo-controlled trials, as they're called, are considered the gold standard in determining whether a drug works. In the case of treatments for Ebola, Geisbert says that is yet to be determined because what works in animals does not necessarily work in humans.
I mean, we don't know if any of these vaccines is going to work in humans, quite honestly.
Canadian health officials hope to have initial results of their VSV vaccine trials in Maryland by December and to move to clinical safety trials in Africa shortly after that, most likely in healthcare workers treating Ebola patients. They are at greatest risk of infection, say public health officials. Geisbert says the vaccines, in particular the VSV, not only have the potential to prevent Ebola, but to treat the disease soon after exposure. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
U.S. President Barack Obama said this week that the risk of a widespread Ebola outbreak in the United States is very low if all the proper protections are taken. Science World's Doug Bernard has the report.
Speaking Wednesday at a cabinet meeting on the Ebola outbreak, U.S. President Barack Obama called for an emergency federal medical team to be immediately deployed to any hospital where an Ebola case is diagnosed to ensure preventive steps are taken.
We're going to make sure that something like this is not repeated and that we are monitoring, supervising, overseeing in a much more aggressive way, exactly what's taking place in Dallas initially, and making sure that the lessons learned are then transmitted to hospitals and clinics all across the country.
Mr. Obama canceled his travel plans on Wednesday for an emergency cabinet meeting after news that a second U.S. health worker infected with the Ebola virus flew on a commercial jet within the United States a day before developing symptoms. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control said that Amber Vinson took a Frontier Airlines flight from Cleveland, Ohio, to the Dallas-Fort Worth airport on Monday. Vinson's case prompted Ohio public health alerts and precautions as state and local officials tried to determine who had close contact with her to prevent the spread of the disease.
The family that was here, that the healthcare worker came to visit, we spoke to her family members, and we're looking at getting information. Now, the thing is that we're looking at being able to construct a good timeline of where the healthcare worker was when she was here and where she traveled and who she was with. And that takes a little bit of time.
Vincent was flown Wednesday from Dallas to Emory University Hospital in Atlanta, Georgia, where two other Ebola patients were brought from Africa and were successfully treated. She and another nurse, Nina Pham, contracted the virus at Texas Health Presbyterian Hospital while treating Thomas Eric Duncan, the Liberian national who last week became the first person in the United States to die from Ebola. The latest numbers from the World Health Organization show there are nearly 9,000 confirmed or suspected Ebola cases in seven countries. To this point, there have been close to 4,500 deaths. For Science World, I'm Doug Bernard.
The European Space Agency announced this week that all systems are go for the Rosetta mission to send its Philae lander to the surface of Comet 67P Churyumov-Gerasimenko on November 12, 2014. Science World's Rebecca Ward tells us more.
Along with setting the date and time for Philae to make the very first soft touchdown on a comet, the European Space Agency has confirmed the location of Philae's primary landing site. About a month ago, after much study, Rosetta mission officials selected what is now being called Site J on Comet 67P Churyumov-Gerasimenko. While preparations are made for the November landing of the Philae, its mothership, the Rosetta, is inching its way closer and closer to the comet 67P. When the Rosetta arrived at the comet in early August, it was about 100 kilometers away. The unmanned space probe is now within 10 kilometers of the comet. ESA officials said that as of now, the Rosetta spacecraft, which has been carrying the Philae with it on a 10-year trip to Comet 67P, will release the air conditioner-sized landing at 0835 UTC on November 12th. Landing, according to ESA, is expected to take place around 1530 UTC. After it lands on the comet, the Philae lander uses its package of science instruments to learn about the physical properties of 67P's surface and subsurface. It will also run tests to determine the comet's chemical, mineralogical, and isotopic composition. For Science World, I'm Rebecca Ward.
Well, we just heard about the European Space Agency's comet-chasing Rosetta mission. For this week's Science World Quick Quiz, we'd like to know, how long did it take for the Rosetta spacecraft to travel from Earth to its target comet, 67P Churyumov-Gerasimenko? Was it a little over A, 10 years, B, 5 years, or C, 2 years? Think about it, and good luck. We'll give you the correct answer just a few minutes from now.
This is Science World on VOA. Be sure to visit our new website and blog,
at voanews.com/science. A group of students at the Stevens Institute of Technology in Hoboken, New Jersey, rose up to a challenge posted by the U.S. Department of Defense. They successfully designed and built an underwater robot for locating submerged unexploded ordnance. Science World's Bob Doty reports.
A group of students tested their underwater vehicle called Perseus II in the 95-meter-long marine research tank at Stevens Institute of Technology. Remotely guided by a computer game controller, the robot dives and gracefully swims back and forth, exploring the tank's bottom with its high-definition video cameras. Over the course of two semesters, five undergraduate students majoring in different engineering areas combined their talents, working between 15 and 20 hours a week, to design and build Perseus II. The project supervisor, research associate Michael DeLorne, says the technical requirements were challenging.
Their goal was to go down and find these unexploded ordnance, and not only just find them, but provide information to an expert on the surface so he or she could make a decision as to whether this was something dangerous or not.
DeLorne says the students came up with some ingenious solutions for complicated problems, such as underwater vehicle positioning.
One unique thing they did, they developed an algorithm that allowed them to autonomously control the vehicle's depth.
Team member Mark Shembab, now a graduate student, says they also came up with an inexpensive way to mark the location of whatever object they found.
One component sank to the bottom and anchored itself, while the other component had a brightly colored orange ball, which would float to the surface and provide a positive identification to a passerby or the authorities to let them know that there's an object down there and we've marked it.
Perseus II was successfully tested at a naval facility in Florida, together with similar robots built at other engineering schools. In the meantime, new students at the Stevens Institute of Technology have already started on the next project, an unmanned aerial vehicle called Perseus III. For Science World, I'm Bob Doty.
Antarctica's ice shelves are melting at a rapid rate, and that as sea levels rise could pose some problems for people who live on or near the world's coastlines. Roseanne Skirbel reports on new research to monitor the temperature of the ice shelf and how fast it's melting in real time using fiber optic cable.
The cable is like the one attached to a television set or computer. The difference is that this one was dropped down a hole through the Ross Ice Shelf, a plain of floating ice in West Antarctica, larger than Germany. University of Nevada hydrology professor Scott Tyler says his team set out to measure the conditions underneath the ice shelf.
We pulse a little bit of light down an optical fiber, and for several kilometers that light goes down the fiber, and we look at the scattering that comes back, and I can then tell you pretty much every second, every meter along the fiber, or sometimes even every 10 centimeters, what the temperature is every second, everywhere, all the time.
Researchers, including an oceanographer from New York University and a glaciologist from Ohio State University, set up a base camp on the ice shelf. The plan was to drill 200 meters through the ice and then extend the cable 700 meters into the ocean under the shelf. Tyler says in the harsh Antarctic climate, the scientists had to work fast.
The ice shelf temperature is as cold as minus 23 degrees C, so it's very cold ice, so the ocean wanted to freeze. And so we calculated we had about at minimum 20 minutes of time to get everything down this little tiny 50 millimeter diameter hole into the ocean before it would freeze solid. And we did.
That cable, by the way, is as thin as a human hair, but encased in a steel tube to protect it from ocean pressure. Once it was plugged into the instruments on the surface, images began to appear on the computer screen of what was happening below. Tyler describes the work in Research Letters, a journal of the American Geophysical Union. He says data flowed almost continuously for 14 months, powered by solar and wind energy.
We collected for the first few months 8 times a day, and then we cut it back down as we got into winter to conserve power.
So you can operate this remotely. You don't have to be out there on the ice sheet. Is that correct?
That's right. We can talk to it by satellite modem. So satellite telephone, probably a little bit like when they're working the Mars rover. It takes a long time to get any information back and forth. But work generally most of the time.
Funded by the National Science Foundation, the project proved that the technology works. Tyler hopes to build a network of such stations across the Ross Ice Shelf and on other big glaciers that are holding back the West Antarctic ice sheets, which otherwise would flow like frozen rivers into the ocean. He adds that as the climate warms, any large glacial melting will affect coastal areas worldwide.
If we raise sea level another meter or two very quickly, then we're going to see a lot more disruption and impact to our infrastructure, things like airports and sewage treatment plants. All the sewage treatment plants are basically at the coast, and they have to operate all the time. They can't be flooded. So our goal is to provide kind of an early warning system, a monitoring system of these shelf glaciers that's easy, it's not doesn't require a lot of instrumentation, that's frozen into the ice.
Tyler says while satellites can and do chart changes in ice shelves from space, the advantage of fiber optics is that it can record those changes in detail on location under the ice. Roseanne Scherbel, VOA News, Washington.
Let's see if you have the correct answer to this week's Science World Quick Quiz. We wanted to know, how long did it take for the Rosetta spacecraft to travel from Earth to its target comet, 67P Churyumov-Gerasimenko? Was it a little over A, 10 years, B, 5 years, or C, 2 years? The answer is A, a little over 10 years. The Rosetta spacecraft, mounted atop an Ariane 5 rocket, was launched from the Guiana Space Center in French Guiana on March 2, 2004. It reached its target comet about 10 years and 5 months later on August 6, 2014. Thanks for playing along with us on this week's Science World Quick Quiz. We'll have another brain teaser for you again next week.
You're listening to Science World on VOA. You can also find us on the Internet. Our new webpage and blog can be found at voanews.com/science.
A group of scientists who work at the World Health Organization's Regional Office for Europe recently conducted a non-WHO-affiliated review of the possible dangers that increased consumption of energy drinks could pose to public health, especially among young people. Energy drinks, which are non-alcoholic beverages, have become very popular with some children, adolescents, and young adults in recent years. Marketed as a product that can help boost energy and increase physical and mental performance, these drinks contain caffeine. Some may also contain vitamins and other added ingredients such as taurine, ginseng, and guarana. Dr. Joao Breda and his colleagues reviewed a number of studies that have been conducted regarding the health risks, consequences, and policies now in place that may relate to the consumption of energy drinks. Dr. Breda joins us for today's one-on-one segment to talk about the review that was conducted, as well as some suggestions that he and his colleagues made in order to reduce the possible harm from the energy drinks. For those of us who don't know much about them, can you give us a little background on energy drinks? What are they?
Well, I mean, they are a kind of drink that tend to have some amount of certain substances that are considered kind of stimulant effect on the central nervous system. I mean, in small amounts, they are basically not harmful, of course. But one of the most known is, of course, caffeine, and caffeine is one of the most used. And in moderation has no problem whatsoever. But in big amounts and, you know, when concentrated in certain products, it can, particularly for children and adolescents, and we're talking about, you know, energy, several drinks in a short period of time, and probably we're talking about children which are more sensitive to the effect of the stimulant and adolescents, and in these cases, some, you know, negative consequences may arise. We're particularly concerned with the mix with alcohol, because these products are stimulants. They, in a way, they are contrary to the effect of alcohol, which is a depressive of the human brain. Therefore, practical terms, you know, young people can continue to drink without feeling very much the effect. So their blood alcohol content can rise, and at the same time, they don't really probably feel so much the effect. So they can drink more, they can be in a situation where they run over more risks without really being conscious of that. And there's reports of, when we looked at the evidence, there seems to be also some situations where the mix with alcohol could actually be somehow worse certain level of preoccupation. One of the things that I believe also characterizes them is that they are, the way they are marketed is not only their composition, but also the way they are marketed to the public and to the consumer target groups. And therefore, you know, like in many other cases, normally we may end up having difficulties in establishing exact definition.
Using caffeine as a way of energizing oneself has been around for a long time. Coffee drinkers who, for example...
No problem. I mean, coffee is a good thing. For adults, coffee has caffeic acid, is an antioxidant. So, I mean, coffee, within certain limits, it's no bad at all. I mean, on the contrary, and many of the negative images that even came from the past about coffee, nowadays they are more or less overcome. I mean, coffee is probably a healthy drink when we talk about energy drinks that are marketed in a fashion that are very much probably looking for young people, and they talk about excess, and it's a different way of communicating it. If you look at the study, just a very humble and initial review, because we don't have studies that are enough to perform a, you know, a, let's say, a more profound review, like a no way a systematic review, because we need more and more research. So there's very little research in the field. That's why we kind of, you know, we look at this because we had questions from, you know, from some countries and some, you know, public health people we worked with, and they thought, well, you know, these energy drinks, some countries in the European region actually took some actions in terms of energy drinks. So it was a little bit of a discussion, and we thought it could be a good idea to try and look at the existing, you know, data and to put together some form of update. And I think, but the thing that we have available, you know, we think that it enough to show that we need to be somehow pay attention to these drinks, and to keep, we need to keep an eye on their effects in terms of public health, particularly with children and young adolescents.
So looking at this from a public health perspective, what do you and your colleagues think should be done to help stem the problems that could result from young people in general using or misusing energy drinks?
I think that the way we see these drinks being marketed, they can be very attractive for children and young adolescents. So I think that should be addressed, although some stakeholders do argue that they already have some kind of self-regulation in place and so on. So I think those mechanisms could be adjusted, that they could be improved. We think that some producers probably wouldn't gain much in having these drinks with huge amounts of these products. I wouldn't like to single out caffeine because it's not the only one. There's more. So I think that we need to be careful with the amounts because, you know, sometimes because of competition, you know, these drinks compete with each other looking at which one is stronger. And we can go over the limit. So we need to possibly producers need to pay attention to the fact that we shouldn't overdo it. I mean, we have to be careful in terms of the amounts and not go to, you know, amounts that are really start to become really dangerous.
That was Dr. Joao Breda. Dr. Breda works in the Division of Non-Communicable Diseases and Life Course at WHO Europe in Copenhagen, Denmark. He also reminds us that although he and his colleagues work for the WHO, their review is not an official report. That's it for this edition of Science World. Thanks so much for listening. Before we go, we'd like to invite you to visit our new website and blog. The address is voanews.com/science. Along with program information, you'll find stories, links, and much more. So stop by and visit us on the internet. The address again is voanews.com/science. Science World has been produced by Bob Doty, and I'm Rick Pantaleo. Be sure to join us either online or on your radio next Saturday and Sunday as we check out the latest in science, health, and technology on Science World.